I've run into some folks that said, well, if this plan gets funded, I'll leave my corporate job. No, you have to leave your corporate job and put your own money in, which will go very fast if you really believe in it, because the investors expect you to do that. You can't say, raise the money, then I'll leave my corporate job. Those are the follow-on employees. That's not the founders.
That was Quan Pham, Chairman and CEO of Westwood Therapeutics Incorporated. Quan is our guest for episode 17 of Innovate Jax, the podcast where we hear the stories of the creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs who will help elevate Jacksonville as a leading southeastern city of innovation. I'm your host, Kate Warnock. Now, on to the interview. Hi, everyone. I am so excited to have our next guest. He's a real luminary in the Jacksonville scene and bi-coastal, as you will learn, Mr. Quan Pham. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, it's good to be here, Kate. Thanks for having me.
We're very excited to have you. So we'll get right started with your questions here. So, you know, I kind of like the last couple episodes that we've had on our podcast. I like our guests to introduce themselves to the audience by naming three traits that you're most known for. What would those be for you?
Well, since I've been around for more than five decades now, I think if you go back and ask my colleagues in the business world, entrepreneurial world, the Marine Corps, and the people I grew up with, they probably would say that I'm a pretty genuine person. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty decisive. And part of that I would have to attribute to my time in the service with the Marines. They taught us very early on to make decisions as a young officer. And probably people would say in the business circle, as well as my friends and on the golf course or the basketball court, that I'm very gritty.
Gritty. Like
I'm
it.
I'm a grinder.
Oh, right. And that's I would say, a pretty common trait to a lot of the entrepreneurs we've spoken to. So, all right, well, let's dive in a little bit into your backstory. Having done some research on you, you do have a really fascinating experience. You moved to the United States from Vietnam as a child with your family. You graduated from UCLA with an economics degree and then immediately joined the Marines and served as an active duty Marine pilot for 7 years before entering the private sector. You wrote a book about your experience, and that book won the Asian Heritage Book Award. So I want to know, amongst all of that, how has your experience shaped you today?
Well, I think, to be clear, we weren't immigrants. We were refugees. Mm. So we came here at the end of the Vietnam War, which was a long and painful part of the American history, but also a very painful part of the Vietnamese history. Several million people died, and we lost over 60,000 Americans whose names are on that wall in Washington, D.C., along with hundreds of thousands wounded psychologically, emotionally, physically. And so I think we were very fortunate, we meaning my family and I and the 1% of the South Vietnamese population that was fortunate to get evacuated by American forces in the days of April 1975. So we were coined the first wave, the lucky ones that got out before the communists took over. So when I came here, I was almost 11, entered the sixth grade. I was taught French in Vietnam as a second language, starting in the second grade. So English was my third language, starting in 1975. And then being in California, Spanish became my fourth language by the eighth grade. But I felt very fortunate to have been afforded the opportunities by this country. But I also grew up in Vietnam, in Saigon, around my father, who didn't make it out of Vietnam in 1975. He was a South Vietnamese officer and a pilot, and he stayed behind and went to the prison camps for 12 years.
Oh, my goodness.
So I saw both sides of the war as a child, as a civilian, but also as the son of a South Vietnamese military officer. And so when I came to the United States, there was always that contrasting memory of your childhood and your father. And then in the 80s, there were a lot of movies about the Vietnam War, some very disturbing movies, Full Metal Jacket, The Killing Fields, Apocalypse Now. And all the movies really didn't paint what I remember of the South Vietnamese military, of somebody like my father. So I had to put all that, you know, behind me. And when I became a citizen in 1984, I felt like I owed the country something more than just taking my citizenship oath, and that was a drive to serve, but also to pursue what I wanted to do as a child in Vietnam. Watching my father fly missions was to become a military officer and a pilot. Now, when I grew up in Vietnam, I had no idea that I would do that in the United States as part of the U.S. Marine Corps.
That's fascinating. What was that like for you, transitioning from a civilian life, even if that was a vision of yours, to enter military service? How were you received?
Well, this was in 1986 now, 11 years after we left Vietnam, and it was the summer that Top Gun came out.
Oh, my goodness.
It was the summer that the movie Platoon came out. So one very positive, very motivating for those who want to fly for the military, especially the Navy. And the Marines train with the Navy, you know, Naval Air Station Pensacola, just west of us here in Florida in the Panhandle. And on the other side was Platoon, a very big movie about the Vietnam War, about the American experience. And so when I got to Officer Candidate School, it was not a pleasant summer. And it's a long ways between Westwood, California, where UCLA was, to Quantico, Virginia, where the Marine Corps Officer Candidate School was held for years.
Right.
And so I think in all fairness, everybody got mistreated or challenged, as we say. Every candidate had a weakness, and it was the staff's job to explore it. For me, it was more psychological than a mental or physical challenge. It was more of, why are you here? Are you a Viet Cong spy? They did everything to trip me up psychologically about what had happened in the Vietnam War in the backdrop of the Hollywood movies and the cultural memories of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
But I think after about 4 to 5 weeks, I got used to it, and I knew it was just that. It was a psychological challenge, and I think everybody in my class, and we had women in one of the platoons, and we had, you know, 5 male platoons, summer 1986, and I think it was up to everybody to survive physically and mentally what the staff threw at us. And just for me, I just knew I couldn't fail. I couldn't fail as a person. I couldn't fail as a new citizen, as a South Vietnamese male. And I couldn't fail because my father was still in prison, held by the communists in the prison camps in the summer of 1986. So once I got through that, things greatly improved for me in the Marine Corps.
I'm glad to hear that. How was your father? Were you able to make contact?
He was released in the summer of 1986. The United States started opening up some talks with, you know, and the war was, in a way, a lost cause. The United States, I think there are some people that said the United States lost the Vietnam War. The United States didn't lose the Vietnam War. The South Vietnamese lost the war. We lost our country. We lost our freedom, and we lost our family. The United States essentially quit the Vietnam War and withdrew.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, my father and the South Vietnamese who were caught had to go pay the price because the Americans were gone. You know, the John McCain's, may he rest in peace, and all the prisoners had been released a long time ago, 1973. We didn't know what happened to him for the first 5 years, and then as relations warmed up and things improved between the two former adversaries, the victors, the North Vietnamese, the communists, finally released a lot of the prisoners. And the higher rank you were, the longer you stayed in. So for him, Lieutenant Colonel, 12 years. And there were some generals that stayed for 15 to 16 years. So he waited 5 years. By 1982, he was able to come.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, for the third time. So he came to the United States in the late 50s to learn how to fly. Then he came back to learn air commando training at Hurlburt Airfield in Destin. And then the third time he came was when he rejoined us in 1992 in L.A.
Wow. I can only imagine what that must have
been
like.
And by that time, we were all adults. My 3 sisters and I were all done with college and into our career. So there was a big gap when you don't see your father for 17 years. But looking back, a lot of the kids with fathers or uncles or maybe mothers or aunts who didn't make it out of Vietnam. So I knew by then, I'd been in the Marine Corps for 5 years, that it was the right thing to do. And it was the best thing I did, come into this country and join the Marines before I entered the private sector.
I can only imagine how proud he must have been to discover where you were when he finally was reunited with your family.
He was very, very happy that I had followed his footsteps, as I would have in Vietnam.
Yes.
I think it's also a tribute to this country that you can pursue your dream. And I had a very specific dream. I didn't look like a Marine. I wasn't very big. I didn't have a name like John Wayne. But I had the opportunity, and that's all you could ask for. There was no guarantee. I had to make it through, just like all the other pilots.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, Kwan, we're going to fast forward just a bit. You know, again, in looking at your background, I think one of the most compelling things outside of your early experience and what formed who you are today is also the fact that you have founded and raised capital for three separate companies since the year 2000. That is quite a feat. I think for our audience in particular, there's so much they're looking for information from people who have lived through this experience and had success. And that's what I'm hoping you can share with us now is in raising that capital, what should startups know about approaching private equity firms? Just if this is their first go, where do you start?
It's a great question. And I've always asked entrepreneurs and having been around Jim Stallings and the PS27 Venture Group here in Jacksonville and a number of entrepreneurs and having been a judge for the EY Entrepreneur of the Year the last 2 years for the state of Florida, I think entrepreneurs have to look at themselves and ask, you know, a number of questions before they start reaching venture capital firms, early stage investors, and private equity to control. If you are going to build a family business and want to be CEO and running this business and turn it over to your kids, it's not a venture capital type of investment. I think entrepreneurs also need to ask about the eventual payback. Most venture firms and private equity firm, you get paid back when the company either goes public or gets acquired. That's it. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at also the time horizon. It's not 20 years. It's not 10 years. It's usually 3 to 5, maybe 7. It's a shorter span than when I raised money in 2000, and which was back in California. They're called Sand Hill Road. It's a famous road in Menlo Park that most of the top tier venture capital firms are located. And so venture capital is early stage, high risk, high return. Private equity is more growth, recapitalization, leverage buyout. And so when you're talking to entrepreneurs seeking that first raise, whether it's from friends and families, angel investors, or a venture firm, you have to make a decision on valuing what are you selling? Are you selling a service? Are you selling technology? Are you selling intellectual property? Are you selling a portion of your company to investors who are going to be on your board and most likely to control your company very early on? Mm-hmm. So that's the trade-off. It's the capital to build your products, your services, and a runway versus control and not having it just you or one or two partners or your family calling all the shots. That's the trade-off. I think you have to make those decisions before you go to certain venture firms. And you have to know what their track record is. You can see where they have invested, at what stage, how much, and in their exits. Most venture firms are very public about IPOs, initial public offerings, and buyouts or mergers and acquisitions. So you can Google all of that. But I think to go blindly without knowing that background would be just a setback. There's just so much information. You have to study up on who you're approaching and see if they are smaller, 500 to 2 million seed investors, or their Series A could be 5 to 7 million. There's just a lot of capital right now, and investors are busy. And they're looking at a lot of deals. They're looking at a lot of executive summaries. And it used to be you needed 20, 25 PowerPoint slides. They only want to see 7 or 8 now in the initial meeting. And so I think all of that, doing your homework on what you're selling, doing your homework on who you're talking with, and being very precise in 7 or 8 slides or in like 15 minutes, because time is very precious and everybody has just a little bit of a shorter attention span these days.
This isn't something that I wrote down for you to ask, so I'm going to spring it on you. Are you always the person that makes the pitch?
I'm always the person who makes the opening remarks, but our chief medical officer, our scientist, I'm in the biotech industry, a biotech company, Westwood Therapeutics, and our CFO also speaks. So I'm not the one speaking the whole time. I don't have to be on every meeting, but I am on the first call and the subsequent call as well as the big call. Investors want to see a team. They don't want to see individuals because that's what they're investing in is intellectual property. Obviously, if you have sales, that's great, but they're looking for potential. They're looking to make an early investment that returns a lot more money than a standard dividend payout. So you have to understand their mathematics. In California, it's a very venture-rich environment, and so you have investors up and down the coast. You also have a network of angels who are mostly executives who have retired or have had exit, and they'll put in their own money before the venture capitalists will come in. So there's it's a great network. Once you've had an exit, people will know you because it's very public. It's in a lot of databases. But I wouldn't say that you have to have a track record to get your first investment. I think if you come prepared, if you come with a very precise pitch, and you come knowing what their sweet spot is, and if that sweet spot, if there's a match, then your chances are good of advancing, not necessarily getting the funding, but going to the next step, which is usually under CDA, data room, then the subsequent meetings and calls. But I think entrepreneurs underestimate how long it takes to close a round.
Mm. You know, Quan, as you talk through everything, I would presume that there would be most of what you just mentioned would hold true regardless of your geography. But what might be different if you're based here in Jacksonville and you're going with a more local equity firm? Any differences that you would say exist?
I think in 2021, I don't think investors care where you are.
Okay.
I think if you have it's not just a business plan. If you have product plans, patent filed but not accepted or granted, if you have great services, you have revenue streams, depending on which business model you're under, I don't think they care.
Okay.
I think they care that you have some intellectual property protection or revenue stream protection, that you have recurring revenue. It's not a one-and-done deal. It's not just pilot programs. That you are able to execute that plan rather than geographic constraints.
So that gets back to the team then. You know, do you have the right team in place?
Do you have the right team in place? And whether in our industry you have people all over the country, sometimes all over the world, can you gather the resources and communicate and execute on your plan within the time frame of the budget and the amount you're asking? That's what it is. You have to be able to convince them that you're asking to sell a portion of your company for, you know, the valuation, getting the amount of raise, and that you can execute the plan under the use of proceeds. Mm-hmm. And usually companies in our sector raise money constantly. Biotech is a very high intellectual property, high capital intensive. So the management team not only have to get the trials done, whether they're in the pre-clinic or in the clinic, but you also have to look at what is the next milestone and the one after that and how much capital you need to get there, and you have to start and you have to think about the value inflection points. And I think I'll mention one more. When I first moved to Jacksonville now 10 years ago, I didn't do the company Sparrow until 2015. And a few people asked me about how much square footage do you need? What kind of company headquarters would you like to build? How many employees are you going to employ or hire? And in our business, it's different. It's about value creation. It's about raising capital, putting it in the science, protecting intellectual properties. We're building potential pharmaceuticals and biotechnology products 10, 15 years down the road for the entire world. So it's a different model than somebody getting, you know, an EBITDA run rate, projecting positively for the last 8 quarters and trying to, you know, raise a large round or try to go public. So it's all different. You have to know the sector you're in and the investors in those sectors and what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. In the biotech world, it's about intellectual property. It's about the team. It's about the science. And it's about value creation. It's just different than, you know, a revenue EBITDA positive business.
So I was going to ask, in your opinion, is there a higher entry barrier for biopharma than other sectors?
I think the barrier is high in every sector when you're starting out. There's no easy way out, and grinding and grit will get you so far. You have to take some risk. I think entrepreneurs need to put their own money in. And so I've run into some folks that said, well, if this plan gets funded, I'll leave my corporate job. No, you have to leave your corporate job and put your own money in, which will go very fast if you really believe in it, because the investors expect you to do that. You can't say, raise the money, then I'll leave my corporate job. Those are the follow-on employees. That's not the founders. I think in Jacksonville, I found that the entrepreneurs and residents are very proud of the city, whether you're at the beach, you're in Midtown, Southside, the West Side. I think Jacksonville, in general, they're very proud. So nobody has told me that because my company's in Jacksonville, the last company, that we're not going to fund you. Mm-hmm. There's no geographical constraints. In the biotech industry now, there is a lot of talent in Jacksonville for staffing, obviously in technology like for Cura, healthcare provider. So there is a very deep talent pool for those sectors. In the biotech industry, usually the hubs are Northern California, Southern California, Boston, Research Triangle Park. You have usually a number of universities with the research capabilities, you know, providing PhDs in chemistry, biology. So that's where the intellectual properties come out for biotech industry. Then you have investors, then you have the talent pool, and that's where it kind of grows on it. For example, the biotech industry was born in the late 70s in California and Boston. Well, you look at the great University of California, you have Stanford, Harvard, MIT. So what happens is the science come out there, you have some scientists and entrepreneurs and investors, and they form great companies like Biogen, Genentech, and then in Southern California, Amgen. Then the executives and the scientists in those big companies either retire early or they leave, and then they start other companies. And that's where you have a big pool of talent. You have a hub, and it kind of feeds on itself. Mm-hmm. And so what I've shared with people in Jacksonville is that it would be really neat if we had a research university here. And the nearest that I know of is Gainesville, and there are a number of biotechs in Gainesville that have gone public and doing very well. Right. So it'll take time, but I think it'll happen in the future because we have the great healthcare system that's here. And with along with that, a lot of potential sites for clinical trials. And you have great physicians and providers in the Jacksonville area. Investors will come.
Quan, I wonder if you run into this yet. I've heard just even from neighbors, but also, you know, heard from business people that there's been a great flight thanks to the pandemic, that now that people have worked remotely for a year or coming up on a year, they really have learned that they can live anywhere. And so lots of people are leaving the more expensive locations like San Francisco, New York City, and they're moving to places like Austin, Texas, and Jacksonville, Florida. Do you think that that's going to kind of recalibrate how people think about putting together that team that you say is so essential, where they're going to headquarter, where they're going to source their talent? How different might it be, you know, 2 years from now that we have kind of, we're at this horizon of the new normal?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Nobody has the exact answer. The excitement is we all project and think about the future as we plan individually and our for companies. I'm fortunate. I get to go back and forth between, I believe, two best states in our country, California and Florida. They're very opposite states. And people in Florida have been asking me for years, California can't sustain itself. It's too high tax rate and too crowded. But you know, the state of California has 40 million people. The state of Florida has 17 million. It's been kind of like that for decades. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see people leave California and come to Texas, Nevada for better, you know, state income taxes. But I think, and I've been to Austin, it's a great city as well. You will see that in this country, we have the freedom to do that. People vote with their feet. And so I think as far as virtual workers, entrepreneurs, you're going to see more national companies than regional companies. You're going to see companies with employees and key management people, board, doing virtual calls. In our industry, we've seen people go public, the whole roadshow, via Zoom. And for biotech companies, that used to be, and Sparrow, my last company, we filed to go public in August of 2018, and it was going to be a, you know, 4-city, 100-fund roadshow physically. In the last 8 months, companies have gone public just by doing all Zoom calls. So in a way, the investor that I've heard speak on webinars say they like it, and so have the entrepreneurs. So they can focus on their business, which is not the travel, but it's the focus on the science and the intellectual property and getting the trials done. Right. That's in our business. Now, I know that in other service-oriented business, people have to see each other in person eventually. And so I think with the vaccines for to fight the COVID pandemic, and we have one coming out from J&J as well, so we'll have three. I think people will start traveling again, and now global travel, I believe, will be slow to regain, you know, the intercontinental travel between North America and Asia and Europe until the whole world can get its hands on the vaccine. But I believe we'll see travel more in the second, third quarter of this year.
Yeah.
I have been traveling since June with all the precautions, but no international travel.
Right, right. You know, Quan, I don't think I've done our audience here any service by not letting you kind of explain what Westwood Therapeutics is. You know, tell us a little bit about that company that you run today.
So Westwood is the college town where UCLA is located, my alma mater. And it's like the Gainesville of the University of Florida. And so we named the company after Westwood because the company licensed three preclinical drugs. And this preclinical means drugs have only been tested in animals, mostly mouse and mouse models. And so we've got three drugs from UCLA about 60 days ago. And so essentially the company's brand new and we're out raising outside money the last 60 days. We do have over $12 million from the National Institute of Health and other agencies. The scientists are terrific, and I couldn't have been more proud with our team and the scientists and believe in us to grant us the licenses as well as the UCLA Technology Development Group. And that's how in our industry, the technology come out of the leading research university or smaller research universities. They will form a team, do the scientific experiment, apply for federal grants or state grants, and get the project to a certain point where they can file a patent. Then the technology transfer office then is in touch with entrepreneurs like myself and my team, and you come to a deal where you have a global license to be able to fundraise and advance the drug candidates beyond just the preclinical, eventually get to the FDA to approve to be tested in human in phase 1, 2, and 3 and get approval and also, you know, produce for the world. Now, in the case of the COVID-19 vaccines, we've seen a record pace of something of that magnitude get moved through the system. I'm extremely proud of our industry as well as all the scientists, as well as the federal agency, the FDA, mm-hmm. and the leadership of our country to be able to get the two vaccines and hopefully three here very soon.
In looking at Florida through that lens of looking at research universities compared to the West Coast, what we have here in the state, you have direct involvement in your career, Quan, with biotechnology here in the state of Florida. What more should we be thinking about, you know, as far as funding those schools, getting more of those research grants? How do we really amplify that ability?
Well, when I started Sparrow in 2014, I was very involved with BioFlorida, the state lobbying effort for the tech, and I was on the board for the last 3 years. BioFlorida has done a lot for the state, and the state has really some great universities, you know, from the University of Florida, Florida State, University of Miami, and then the hubs of schools down in the Tampa area, South Florida, and in Orlando, UCF. And I've spoken with at least half of the technology transfer offices. So it's not that the state doesn't have the resources, and it's there, but you have to find a fit. Some universities are known for out-licensing their oncology products, some cardiovascular, some, you know, diabetes. So I think you have to have a fit between the expertise of the founding team of the company, the scientists, and investors who will invest in certain therapeutic areas. Now, some investors will invest across every therapeutic area at every stage, but then there'll be very focused investors. But as far as the state of Florida, you know, I've mentioned to a number of people here in Jacksonville that when you look at the University of North Florida, you look at the UF health system that's here, and then you look at Jacksonville University. Those are your choices of where a research university could be funded and started, a PhD program in chemistry and biology. That's where the fundamental science is discovered and tested. And that's where the great technologies are coming out of the other leading research university. So you have to have stakeholders. You have to have alumni. You have to have legislatures to fund such a program, but it can be done. I've spoken to a number of people, but once again, you have to have, is it important for Jacksonville? I mean, Jacksonville has a very diverse economy. Mm-hmm. Does it want a biotechnology? If you do, if the city does, then you invest in it, and that's how you do it. If you don't, then what it's going to take is a local company, whether it's Northeast Florida or in Jacksonville, to be successful. And then from there, usually you will see alumni, just like the other companies in Jacksonville. They'll go out and form companies because now they're used to living here. They know the great quality of life. They have the financial resources. And they get to do their second and third acts. And that's how each hub grows with the successes. You will see alumni from the big biotech from 25, 30, 40 years ago now mentoring and investing in the other companies that are being born as we speak.
All right, Quan, I want to pivot a little bit in this conversation, this amazing content that you've just given our audience who are very entrepreneurial minded, but you have another role here locally. You sit as the board chairman for Jacksonville chapter of Volunteers in Medicine. And earlier in describing our city, we have...
Let's back up. I'm just a director. I'm not the chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. My bad. No. All right. Thanks for the clarification. But we have these amazing health systems, you know, that proliferate through the city. And yet with those amazing centers of medicine, there's a disconnect to the access to that care. So in your perspective, I'd like to hear, how do we define what that gap is and how do we close it? And how is Volunteers in Medicine trying to really make a difference?
Yeah, so I'm very proud. This is my second year on the board of Volunteer Medicine Jacksonville. And the acronym is VIM, VIM. We provide health care for the working uninsured. So those who have to work full time but don't have health care insurance, that's the gap. So if you fall below a certain level of income, you're going to get care. And if you work for a state, local, or federal agency, you're going to have insurance. And most private employers a certain size will have insurance of some sort. So Volunteer Medicine provides that care for the working uninsured. It's a great organization with a lot of people, a lot of great alumni. And so even then, I think we're not catching everybody. And so you have the political discussions of free care for everybody to the Obama healthcare plan that was so much debated and implemented. And then you have those who are retired that are covered by private insurance and Medicare. But I think the working uninsured is where Volunteer Medicine has made the most impact. I think even with the pandemic, I'm very proud of the staff. And we have a lot of volunteers, providers, pharmacists, nurses, retired physicians that come in. We have a clinic on the west side, but the main clinic is downtown. And so I'm just doing my part just to making sure that, you know, we, you know, stay open as well as get the funding necessary, not only through fundraising, but also from individual donors, and to keep that service. I think it's important for Jacksonville that we can expand it more so we can catch everybody.
So how do people find out about you? How do they discover that the services are available?
We have reached out to all the hospitals in Jacksonville, as well as the network of volunteers. Also, you know, we do a lot of charity fundraising event. We have a big one in February, Women with Heart in February. It's going to be a virtual event like most of the honorees over the last year. They've all been honored virtually. And so all the award ceremonies and all of those. But we're continuing with getting the word out so people know that there are two sites in Jacksonville for the working uninsured, that they can get great primary care health care, as well as a number of services for women as well.
Is it on the agenda to expand either the number of services that you can offer or your locations?
Yes. And Jennifer Ryan, our chief executive officer, has done a great job. And it would be somebody I would have on this show to talk more about that as an entrepreneur and as a leader of volunteer and medicine in Jacksonville.
Good to know. Thanks for the referral. All right. There's another connection among you and two other Innovate Jax guests we have featured, Andre Wallace and Raghu Misra. You all actively engage and support career development in our area's high school students, which I think is fantastic. Tell us about your role on the Ponte Vedra High's Board of Advisors, and why is it important to focus on our younger generation this way?
Yeah, so I was introduced to the Ponte Vedra High School Biotechnology Advisory Board a few years ago, and there are a number of former executives in healthcare, retired executive as well, and several active from the local Johnson & Johnson, the Vistacon. And so we all have an interest in helping the young students learn about careers in the sciences, whether it's research or on the business side of the biotech and pharmaceuticals. And so it's several times a year we meet. The students look at their science projects and give them some feedback, and then we'll have career days where each one of us will come in for a breakfast at the high school, and then the students can come ask us questions, different career tracks, whether they're going to pursue an undergraduate degree in chemistry and go on to do a master's and a PhD to go into research, or they intend to be a healthcare provider, a medical doctor, a nurse, or a physical therapist. But eventually, some of them will get exposed to the biotechnology, medical device, or pharmaceutical. And at that point, we try to give them the you know, the pluses and the minuses of each career track. And that's our job as the advisory board is, if they love science, if they love inventing, if they love academics, and they have an interest in how products are developed. You know, we take it for granted the FDA just grant approvals or things that are on the shelf at Walgreens Pharmacy, or if you get sick, those products take a long time to develop. We do have a federal agency that oversees the whole process. And then you have also a business. You know, each of those products belong to a business that would like to protect their intellectual properties from, you know, foreign copies or domestic copies, and also the safety for the public. Not only do the products have to be efficacious, that they have to work in humans, but they also have to be safe. And so the whole business of getting products to approval is the first step, but also the mass production under quality supervision, as well as being safely manufactured and distributed globally, is a very massive. So we try to provide those perspectives from each of our careers, whether it's J&J, Pfizer, or Merck, all the way down to a small startup like Westwood, to see where the students would fit in down the road if that's what they would like to do after they pursue their science degrees.
Do you see the interest is building year over year?
I think there's a great interest when we're able to tell them the end product, just as I just shared with you, that we take it for granted these products. Some of these products have been around for years and they've been very safe and there's no innovation. But if there's no innovation, there are going to be new diseases, there are going to be bacterial resistant, new strains of things that could get us. So there's got to be innovation. And we try to link it back to, that's why innovation starts with research. Mm-hmm. Good research, good trials. And it has to be a public-private venture because the universities can't commercialize. And entrepreneurs and scientists can't massively distribute a global drug. And even small biotech companies or large biotech companies, they need a Pfizer, they need a Merck, they need a Johnson & Johnson to globally make a big impact on not only the quality, the production, but also the distribution of something like the COVID vaccines.
Do you think that there's going to be, everybody's heard of the Fauci effect, a lot of students who, you know, their eyes have been opened to the power of having a career in medicine and going that path. Do you think that there's going to be a similar awakening to the need for a better investment in public health?
Well, I think it's clear after 9/11, the firefighters, the EMS, the, you know, first responders, we saw their bravery, we saw their training, we saw the big impact they had, also the 9/11 attack, but also our military during the last basically two decades of wars. And if you want to go back another decade to the Persian Gulf, I think with the pandemic, you've seen frontline healthcare workers and their bravery and what they've gone through and the impact they've made. Had they not been there and gone to work and stayed home like most of us, who known would have been the casualty rates may have been higher. So I think you definitely see frontline healthcare workers, you definitely see nurses, you definitely see physicians, ER, all across. They're good role models for the kids to see. So it's not all entertainment, it's not all athletic, and it's not all entrepreneur and business. Now, once again, at the Academy, we try to link the science, the research, the clinical work. We tell them about physicians who've gone into biotech. We talk about pharmacists who've gone from pharmacy school to Walgreens to work at a hospital and then joining the drug company. So we try to share that to them so they see the opportunities and the roadmap that some professionals like to stay in research, some professionals like to move around, some professionals go from medical school straight to big pharma to do research, and some professionals, you know, come as consultants and practice medicine at the same time. So there's a variety, and that's what we're trying to share with the students. And some are 10, 20 years away from that, but at least while they're in their junior and senior year, they can see that after undergraduate, after master's, after PhD, they have options. They're not going to be in a lab. They don't have to be behind a counter. They don't have to be, you know, in an OR. There are different career paths.
Right.
And I think physicians will tell them one path, pharmacists would tell them, research would tell them. We try to tell them these are the things we have seen in our careers with regards to starting out as a scientist or a researcher.
Right, right. All right, well, Quan, we're going to close with two reflections that I'm going to ask for you. And the first one is professional. What's your best advice for any startup looking to find success in 2021?
I think my advice would that put your best foot forward and don't use the global pandemic or any other things you can't control as an excuse to not have a plan, not have a product, are not being able to raise money because you can't control those things. Mm. You know, you can only be prepared and you can only practice your pitch and hone your deck. Those things you can do.
All right, stay focused. All right. And the last one is a personal reflection. You started life in the United States as a refugee who didn't even speak English, although you spoke more than one language, not English. And you're now a model for entrepreneurial success. Any advice for people who find themselves now at a disadvantage, especially due to the COVID crisis?
Yeah, I think it's set a lot of people back. I think you have to be honest with yourself and your loved ones about the runway that you have. And I remember sharing this with a number of Jacksonville entrepreneurs about 5 years ago. I said, just do an experiment. If you want to start a company and you want to bring in investors, you know, be expected to leave corporate America, no salary, pay for your own benefits and use your savings. And just do an experiment. Just don't look at your paycheck and just see what your living expenses are and then start using your savings to live on, and also write checks for your new company. You can see how fast the cash go. And if you don't have the runway or the stomach, then maybe put it off. But if you have to do it now, you have to do that exercise. And I think I mentioned that to somebody, and I said, I would recommend you stay with your full-time job because you're not ready to do that. And I think years later, she kind of admitted that she was jumping in too early. Mm. So I think you have to do that exercise. I think you have to always think that things are going to take longer. Fundraising, building a product, hitting your revenue goals. We're all very optimistic as young entrepreneurs, and now not as young entrepreneur, that you're doing a new company in a new space. You have to convince people, and people, professionals especially, they're set in their ways, the way businesses are run, the way they spend their corporate money, and you have to decide if you're going to go sell services or product to the public, you know, more of a retail or a business-to-business, a professional sale, because it takes a little time to convince people. So the runway needs to be longer than what you think it's going to be.
All right. Quan Pham, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And as a helicopter pilot, I'm always so used to short runways. Thanks for having me.
All right. Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Innovate Jax. For show notes and a list of all our episodes, go to Furkura.com/InnovateJax. Know a Jacksonville changemaker who'd make a great podcast guest? We want to hear from you. Message us at InnovateJax@Furkura.com. Thanks for listening.